On another note, I did send the book off to the printer. The printer has it. They're going to send me the proof copies. I'll send them back right away this week. And then they'll be printing the book. The book is ready to go. So Clint's doing an e-book. So that should be ready, you know, soon, you know, before the book. He asked, he says, do you want to save the e-book until the book comes out? I said, well, that's the way you should do it if you're trying to make money. You want to get everybody to buy the book. But he says, we're trying to get out the information. So the e-book may come out, you know, 6 weeks before the actual book does. But and we're printing 5,000 copies. So if you want a book, you don't get one. You get a box. So then my distribution plan, how are you distributing this? Well, you're looking at the distribution team right at those tables. So, but that's what we'll do. And if you like it, hand it out. Of course, if you don't, then you don't need to feel responsible to hand it out. But tonight we are in Habakkuk chapter 2. I appreciate you coming back after last week of where we just kind of meandered and wandered around. But Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 5 through 8. I'll read through this. And again, this is Habakkuk receiving an answer from the Lord. He's concerned with how corrupt his culture is, but also God's answer is, I'm going to bring the Babylonians in, and Habakkuk can't understand that. And so his second response is chapter 2, verse 2. After Habakkuk says, I'll stand at my watch and wait to see what the answer is and get ready to reply. It says, chapter 2, verse 2, then the Lord replied, write down the revelation, they mean he's revealing something to Habakkuk, and make it plain on tablets, so that the herald may run with it. And again, that would be something that they'd write it down, and they'd run either running from city to city to make an announcement, probably running for more than just one place, running from one king to another king, but running and proclaiming an announcement throughout the land. And it may even indicate throughout time, not just across the land, but throughout time. And that's where we're at today, looking at it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. In other words, this is how it's going to happen, but the fulfillment is always going to be in the future. So as we're looking at the answers tonight that is given to Habakkuk, it's not like, hey, this is the answer to your prayer, and so it's going to be resolved in the next couple days. It's like, here's the answer to what you're concerned about, but you're not going to see the answer until sometime in the future. Similar to the martyrs under the throne in the fifth seal, how long, O Lord, are we going to have to wait? Just a little longer until this vision has run its course. So there are answers that God is going to provide for us, but sometimes we have to wait for them. And so that's what's being said here again. For the revelation awaits an appointed time, and then very clearly it says, it speaks of the end. This is the end. As history's going this way, it is right here. It's not an answered prayer here, an answered prayer here, or some resolved conflict. It is the ultimate end of when this is ultimately fulfilled. This will no longer be a problem. This will no longer be a question. But yet until then, there's going to be this this problem of evil. But yet evil is going to be used by God to create good. And that is going to continue throughout time. And eventually evil will be completely eliminated. And the only thing that will be left will be the good. But it's not something God can just snap his fingers and take care of. It's a process we have to live through. So as we look at this, what's going to come up in the next verse, to endure this time period of where there is evil and God is allowing evil to be here, you're going to have some information. You're going to have some knowledge. You're going to trust that information. You're going to have to trust God. You're going to have faith. And if you are a person that's going to be able to look at all this and have faith and trust God, you will then live. You will be living and make it through this. If you are not going to have faith, if you're going to be arrogant and you're going to be participating, trying to use this evil to your own advantage, then there's going to be, you will perish. And that's where the sixth verse comes up. It says, verse 4, well, I'll finish reading. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. This is going to happen just like this. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come, and it will not delay. It's on track. It will come to pass. Now, here's verse 4. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright. So he, that would be the person that is doing this evil, that is thinking he's using everything in the system to his own advantage, whatever it is. He is puffed up, or it means he's arrogant. His desires are not upright. There's something wrong with his soul. His soul is lacking. It's not upright. It's not true. It's something perverted, and it's going to try to get everything here, and the result is this person's going to perish. And the person we're talking about in context is the Babylonians or Nebuchadnezzar. The contrast, it says, but the righteous will live by his faith. And there it is right here. The righteous, if you're going to be right, it's not going to be up here in your own self-vindication, your own working of the system. There's only one way to be right, and that is to give up on this and trust God, and then you will live. And so I've got on the page one of the notes, just a few things in review. Point one there, it says just or righteous is a word that means there is a direct connection of being declared judicially in your judicial standing. His actions or morals is not official until the judge evaluates it. The judge that's evaluating it is the Lord. And the connection there, I made a little box. I thought it made it a little clearer in that box. There's two people. And they are the proud. We'll say this right here. The two groups of people, the two people are the proud and the righteous. And there is two parentheses, there's four boxes, four columns. One, two, three, four. I've got parentheses in two places. The proud are not upright. There's something wrong with them. They're not upright in his soul. His soul is not right. Now, the righteous over here, in his soul, he's going to have faith. He's going to have faith, and the result is he will live. So, this person, the proud, in his soul, it's not upright, but the righteous, because of faith, they will be righteous. We're going to fill this in right here. That's parentheses. This is a parenthesis. The proud are not upright in their soul. The righteous have faith, so they are righteous by that faith. And the result is they're going to live. So in parentheses over here, the result is death, or they will perish. So the proud is not upright in his soul. The result is death. The righteous have faith, and thus they are righteous. They're not corrupt. And the result is going to be they're going to live. These are the only people that are going to be able to make it through this scenario that is being said right here. And now we're going to switch after introducing this. The righteous, Habakkuk, his people will be righteous by faith, and they're going to live throughout this event. And in the end, they'll be proven righteous or declared righteous. Now, what about this proud? The proud is going to think they're winning. It's going to look good. You know, in history, it's going to look good for a while, but something's not right. It can't work. It's like a plane that's not built correctly. It's like anything, you know, that in nature that's not correct. Something's not right. It's going to perish. And so the person, the proud person or the proud nation, there's something wrong with their soul. They're going to perish. And so now we swing into that. And now if you turn the page, well, just right there. Well, let me read. Let me read on in the NIV, just in the text here. Chapter 2, verse 4. See, he's puffed up. He's arrogant. His desires are not right. His soul's not right. But the righteous will live by faith. Verse 5. Indeed, now it describes the proud. And there's several things in this verse. Wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death, he is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. So, we've got the word wine. So, it says, indeed, wine is an issue here. And then it's going to be arrogant, or the proud again. And this person is somehow betrayed. He's misled. Just like you take wine into an arrogant person, they're going to be not have any judgmental skills. And for example, here it is. The wine betrays him. He is arrogant. I want to make sure I spelled that word right on the board. He's never at rest. never at rest. He is greedy. And what is said right here is greedy as Sheol. Another way of saying that would be the underworld. The word is Sheol. And we'll talk about what that refers to. Greedy as the grave or Sheol. Like death, never satisfied. And takes captive nations and takes captive all the peoples. So these right here are similar. Conquers all the nations. It says, gathers to himself the nations and takes captive the people. These are similar. The underworld is never satisfied. Death is never satisfied. The idea there, and I will mention it again, the underworld, people continue to die and go into the underworld, especially in Habakkuk's day. Everyone who died went to Sheol, went to Hades, went to the underworld. But it never got filled up. So death is never satisfied. It's not like, well, we got too many people here. Like overpopulation. It's like it was never an issue. The people just kept going, and there's always ample space. Never at rest means they're never content. In other words, what we're looking at here, like arrogance or an addiction to wine, it's going to cause this, you've got to have more. So there's always going to be the conquest. There's no way of satisfying. And they just keep capturing these people. This is a problem. That's what's being said right here. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest because he is as greedy as the grave or Sheol. And like death is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. So with this being said, it looks, this would be like maybe in some circles, this would be the definition of an outstanding leader, an outstanding man. They're never at rest, never stopping. They're never satisfied. They're always going. Once they get something, they're going to just keep going. And it's going to look, but this right here is a fault. This, something's not right in their soul. This is going to crash every time. The only way to escape this is to get a perspective from the biblical perspective and be righteous by faith. Left in this, it's going to self-destruct. That's what the rest of this chapter is going to be about. So turn the page, and we've got in the English Standard Version and the, here at the bottom of the page. We'll look at this here. Moreover, chapter 2, verse 5, in the English Standard Version, the bottom of page 1, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects all his own as his own all peoples. And so that is the English Standard Translation. Turn the page, and let's go ahead and read down to verse 3. Bottom of page 3, chapter 2, verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, and now begins in chapter 2, verse 6, the five woes. So this is what it says after saying, you've got the arrogant and the righteous. Something's wrong with the arrogant. Something's not right in their soul. This is the way they act. It looks good, but in the end, will not those who they have oppressed look back and mock them and taunt them and make riddles and proverbs about them because they're so typical. And that is what's going to take place. And so as we look at this, we want to break down that verse 6 on page 5. Go to page 2 on the notes. And there you've got the Hebrew written at the top there with the transliteration. I'm just going to read through the Hebrew so you can see kind of the words that are used. It says, and indeed, looking from the right, going left, and indeed, because by wine he transgresses. Now, remember it said betrayed or was a traitor. Now it uses the word he transgresses. Or in other words, because of wine, he goes beyond what he should have gone. It's similar. He is a man proud. And not, he does stay at home. He doesn't stay at home. He's proud, so he doesn't stay at home. The ideal is continuously conquering. He's both politically and militarily addicted. He's addicted to power. He's addicted to conquering. Because he enlarges as hell his desire. meaning it's never full. Your desire, once you're addicted, if it be wine or if it be a political power, once you're, it's like you can never stop. You can never say, okay, I've had enough. And he, because he enlarges as hell his desire, he is and like death and cannot be satisfied. So like death, he cannot be satisfied. And he gathers to himself all nations and heaps up for himself all peoples. Now, these nations and peoples that he's using his aggression with are going to be the ones eventually, when he gets stretched out so far and starts to crash, they're going to turn on him and start mocking. And that is, we talk about the cycle of history, that is what's taking place throughout history. If it be the Assyrians, we saw it over here. They're going to fall, and they became very weak. They became very weak in Ashurbanipal's final years. And eventually, Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar rose up. Now you got the Babylonians. But the thing is, they're the same thing. They're going to cycle through. And those who are going to mock them are going to be those they oppress, which would be the Persians and the Medes. And they're going to become, until eventually, the Greeks. The Persians invade the Greeks. You have the story about the 300 of the Greeks. And eventually, Alexander comes and takes those. And then, of course, here comes Rome. And this continues all the way up until Babylon the Great. Whatever Babylon the Great is, if it's a rebuilding of Babylon, if it's some modern, you know, institution or country or empire, if it be the United States or possibly the Western world moving back into the East, you know, whatever this is, it's all going to cycle until eventually God is going to put a stop to it in the end. But every one of these empires are going to fall. That's why you look at anything that is ungodly that's rising up in power. It may be terrifying, but it's not going to last. It's going to fail. That's why you look at, for example, in Hope for America's Last Generation and in other times, we talk about the invasion of Israel by Gog and Magog. Whenever that happens, if it's pre-tribulation or if it's at the end, if it's part of Armageddon, you know, if it's after the second coming and the establishment of the kingdom, whenever it takes place, then there's ultimately the end at the millennium, a second time. But the terrorist states, as they begin to expand and you know, use their force, they're only one of these cycles. If you want to stick in here some kind of a terrorist state right here, whatever's happening, God is going to just use them to overthrow this one to bring about the next one. But there's no sustaining them. And that's why, as you look at this history, you've got to have the righteous will live by faith, knowing, don't be impressed. They're going to crash. Every one of these is built like a plane that's too heavy. It's going to crash because of their arrogance. They can't stop. They're addicted to political power. They're addicted to military power. They'll just keep right on going. And the Babylonians will be mocked by the Persians. The Persians will be mocked by the Greeks. The Greeks will be mocked by all the way through. And eventually, there's a taunt in the book of Revelation taunting Babylon the Great. Aren't you Babylon the Great? The same thing. They're not going to last. And that's what's going to take place here in the rest of this chapter. There's going to be five woes of taunting this Babylon. And here we go. On page 2, I'm going to read through the notes. It says, after saying the righteous will live because of faith, but the arrogant have something wrong inside their soul, they'll eventually destroy themselves. Habakkuk now describes those without faith and how they will be destroyed. Now, the point 2 there, it says, wine betrays him, or wine is a traitor. Or also, by wine he transgresses, or wine betrays an arrogant man. So you've got the ideal of betray, transgression, and again, this wine, is this wine actual wine? Well, first of all, in Babylon, and you know, I've got this written down, oh, somewhere, yeah, down there, point D, 2D, point E. Interestingly, it says Babylon's last days were spent drinking wine at Belshazzar's party, and I've got it written out here. The ancient historians, when they describe the Babylonians of Nebuchadnezzar's day and after, they talk about their wine. They talk about how heavy a drinkers they were. That's what the ancient historians. And the Bible captures that here in 5 verses. Just listen to how often it comes up in 5 verses. The last Belshazzar, right here, Nabonidus was his father, the last king of Babylon. He went south, as you know, and left Belshazzar in the city of Babylon and called his son king of Babylon. But Nabonidus was the king of the empire. So Belshazzar is mentioned here in chapter 5. Interesting, it says, King Belshazzar, this is right out of the NIV text, chapter 5 of Daniel. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles. Now, okay, this is very pertinent. Nabonidus had gone south from Babylon. He'd gone south to build some temples in the south to try to please the gods, hoping he could get some momentum to save his empire because he knew the gods were the ones that were judging him. Belshazzar stays in Babylon. Cyrus had already conquered all of taken all this territory down and had surrounded Babylon. There was nothing left. The only thing left was the walls of the city of Babylon. Everything had collapsed. The only, just like we go back to Jonah's day, Nineveh, where there's a 100-mile radius around Nineveh of the Assyrian Empire. Jonah came, it began to expand, and we had this empire arose. Babylon is in the same position, all they've got. Cyrus is outside the walls of the city in chapter 5. Now, again, keep this in mind, because we are in a culture that if you look at the culture, everybody says something's wrong. Our culture is declining. How you say, well, I think it's the education system. I think it's the politics. I think it's the media. I think it's Hollywood. I think it's religion. I think it's the church. I think it's foreign immigration. I think it may be drugs and alcohol. However you want to play it, something's weird. Something's wrong. Something's collapsing. I mean, do we need to give examples? You got the Afghanistan. Was that just, were we just like purposely giving up? I mean, is that us betraying our country to get favor because they know this ship is sinking and the elites are siding with another set of elites somewhere and the middle class is just going to get buried? Is that what's going on? It's like, but anyway, whatever you think, look at this. Belshazzar and the people of Babylon, they were surrounded. They had no hope. So what they did was this. They die this night. Tonight, this is the night Belshazzar dies. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles. Now, notice, he's just in Babylon. They didn't come from somewhere else. They're just in Babylon. They're in the city. He's got 1,000 nobles in, and just like we saw when we talked about Assyria falling in Nahum, one thing they handed out was titles, positions. Everyone was a noble. Everyone was a prince. Everyone had a degree. Everyone was something. To the place that it meant nothing. Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, that would refer to not just father, and the people say, oh, see, the Bible's not right. The word also means grandfather. It means his predecessor, so it doesn't mean his dad. But notice what he does. The last thing he does, the last thing he's thinking, they're collapsing. He's going to go get the golden goblets that were taken out of the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon. He goes and gets those. I mean, that says something. His final thoughts were, I'm going to drink wine out of the goblets of the temple. Why hadn't they been using these before? I mean, if they're that great, why didn't they say, hey, we use these every night? It's like, wait, we're going to get the really good stuff, I guess. He gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, he just keeps repeating over and over. They've got one thing, they're surrounded. So what are they doing? They're drinking. That's what they always did, was drink. And now they're going to bring in the golden goblets from God's temple. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze and iron and wood and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. And then you know that rest of that story. And again, that palace has been excavated many years ago, and they found the royal room that this would have taken place, and there's a plastered wall left there that they excavated. They found, now again, if it's exactly the right wall, exactly the right room, but they're right there in the territory of that. Nonetheless, when we talk about wine, it could simply be alcoholic wine. Or this wine could be you being used as an illustration. Like you can be addicted to wine and then begin to make bad decisions. Your arrogance would be betrayed by wine. You're arrogant and then you drink wine and now your arrogance becomes full-blown and it takes you places you don't want to go. You expand the borders beyond where you want to go as a country or as an empire. It'll make you never stop until you end up making it like an airplane that will not fly. This wine betrays. So again, I think you can consider the wine as an actual force in this, or the wine is being used as an illustration of what your arrogance can do with this drive of the human nature. But I'm going back to point two. Point two, wine betrays him, or it could be translated, wine is a traitor, or by wine he transgresses, or wine betrays an arrogant man. Point A, betrays or traitor is from the word begad, and you can see it here, it's boadgad, it's up there in the text, meaning to act treacherously or to deal treacherously. So wine acts treacherously. Earlier in chapter 1, the same word was translated treacherous. Wine leads the arrogant man further on than wisdom would allow. If you weren't addicted, if you weren't under the influence of wine or maybe under the influence of your extreme arrogance, you'd stop and say, wait, this is not wise. Now, watch this. In the point B, 1, in the Masoretic text, we always talk about, not always, but we've mentioned it before, how the Masoretic text, that is what we get all of our translations, the King James, the NIV, the English Standard, all the translations. The Masoretic text is the text that the Jews handed down year after year. That when you hear stories about them writing out the text and then counting the letters from the end, counting the letters from the beginning and having to end up on exactly the right letter, and if they don't, they burn the scroll. That's how they kept it pure all those years. The Masoretic text, I can't remember right offhand. I think our oldest is like, 1000 A.D. is the oldest Masoretic text. And so that's what all the Old Testament is always based on, this Masoretic text. When they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, 1948 and there, they began now, they all of a sudden had an Old Testament text that, again, when I say the Masoretic text, I'm talking about the Hebrews copying it. You've got the Old Testament recorded in, like the Sinaitic Codex Sinaiticus, and Codex Vaticanus, or Vaticanus. There's Old Testament there too, but it's taken from, like the Septuagint, from the Greek into the Latin or into some other language. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls are going to go back to possibly 200 B.C., maybe before, but they're being copied, in the first century. Let's just say 70 A.D. would be a good, that's when they were being copied. There's some manuscripts that old. When they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, all of a sudden, you could take 1000 A.D. and push it back a whole millennium, because these were virtually word for word in agreement, meaning they had copied it successfully. From what they had in 70 A.D., they copied it and preserved it successfully for 1,000 years. And there's your proof. But in this case, right here, this is one of those places. In the Masoretic text, it says wine. That's why your Bibles all say wine right there, because they're all using, am I correct? They're all using the Masoretic text. The Dead Sea Scrolls did not use the word wine. They, at this point in the book of Habakkuk, the word was wealth. Their wealth betrays them. Now, I'm not going to do anything with that information. I mean, it's interesting right here in understanding that. But the word wealth, the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Dead Sea at Qumran in Israel in the first century, they would read that their wealth betrays them. Their wealth makes them treacherous, or they begin to sin. So keep that in mind. That's just information. Point C, likewise, the Babylonians are led further into their vices by wine, or by their arrogance, their overconfidence. And they are never at rest, meaning they're always going further to conquer, further than they should have. I mean, just think of life this way. It can be applied individually, or it can be applied as a nation. You get drunk in your arrogance. Even the book of Revelation talks about the beast and the people involved in the kingdom of the beast being drunk on you know, the wrath of God. They've drunk full fury from the full force from the fury of the wrath of God. Or being drunk on the blood of the martyrs. They've killed, and so now they're arrogant, they're conquering, and so they're drunk with their arrogance. They can't think, they don't see where they're heading. They're heading towards judgment. And that's what's being said right here. Habakkuk is being told by God, don't worry, you got to stay in faith. These people are blind. The Babylonians are going to come, they're going to become arrogant, and the very thing that they're overriding you with and crushing your country is going to cause them to crash themselves. You're going to go through persecution. But understand, those who are persecuting you have such momentum, they're like a truck. I got it written down here somewhere too. They're like a truck going down a hill without brakes. It's like they're going full speed. Look, it's like, but they can't stop. You start persecuting, you start dominating, nothing's going to stop you. The only thing that could stop you is the grace of God, the wisdom of God. But the carnal man with wealth, with drunk on arrogance, is going to just roll right over themselves. They're going to perish. Just step back in your faith and watch them perish. Now, I'll say this as I talk, because I have found myself, I tell Tony this, and you may be in a similar situation. You know, you see what's going on, like with the Taliban, for example, and they're persecuting Christians. Islam persecutes Christians. I found myself reading different posts, different blogs, different articles, and I'm more of, again, this is me being honest, looking at myself and reflecting. It's like I'm looking at the Taliban or Islam or what's going on in the world in different places as this right here, as Babylon, as the arrogant, drunk with wine, thinking they've got power, and just, hey, step back and just watch them roll right off the cliff. They can't be stopped. Just watch them. They're going to destroy themselves. And that's what God is telling Habakkuk. And you know, that's the way, you know, eschatologically, that's what's going to happen. It's just going to keep going, and they just continue rebelling against God until Jesus comes back and puts an end to it. I read some posts, and they talk about the underground church in Afghanistan, and some talk about them being martyred and slaughtered, and Christians are being killed, which is true. I don't know all the stories, but it's true at some level. I know it takes place in Nigeria. I mean, I know that for a fact. But others talk about the church. They always talk about the church being bold, but some are in the sense they're bold as they go to their death. Some are talking as if they're bold, showing joy and ministering to the Taliban in their actions, and that the Taliban, and they're praying that, you know, eventually the Taliban is going to see the joy and the hope that is in these people, the church, and they're going to come to Christ. And they're praying for a revival in the Islamic world to coming to Christ. And it's like, you know, it's like, huh, I'm not. It's like, I'm watching, waiting for them to go off the cliff. And so, I mean, that's why you check yourself. It's like, whoa. And so it's like, wait, of course your goal is to minister. And even Tertullian said, you know, as we've talked before, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. If they do start to persecute Christians, which they are, and these Christians stand firm, the typical response is Christianity begins to grow and spread at some level, although there's a place where Christianity has been exterminated in certain countries, but it begins to spread because that's what happened, the joy, the testimony, and there's hope in that. So I was kind of torn between that because it's like I see the persecutors heading towards judgment. But at the same time, there is that word of hope that they see the people they're persecuting, and they come to Christ. And then I started thinking, and again, I'm thinking, you know, why am I like, why am I not thinking about, you know, an Islamic revival? Why am I not thinking about turning the world to God? And you know why? Now, here's the thing. This is where you got to check yourself. And this is why theology is important. Because of eschatology. My eschatology says the world is going to hell and Jesus is going to come back and bring judgment. And so, and I've had conversations about this with other people before, even many years ago, but it's like my eschatology, be careful now, I don't want to overspeak, but I've got to watch myself, depending on that, I don't want to speak for all of you, but it's like you're almost excited about the end of the world. It's like I'm almost excited about, you know, persecution and disaster, because the more we get, the quicker we're going to get to the coming of Christ. And again, that may or that may not be true. It may continue to cycle. But now watch. I'm amillennial, meaning Jesus is going to come back before the millennium, and then he'll set up his kingdom. But if you are amillennial, if you think the church is the kingdom of God on earth, and there are people like that, and you know, I don't want to act like it's some hidden group, but a good vast majority of churches, if they even know what their theology is, are amillennial. They think the Catholic Church, for example, is not a premillennial return of Christ, because the Catholic Church is the kingdom of God on earth. And then many of the Reformed churches that come out of that, the early Protestant churches, they're still in amillennialism. And they're thinking that, I would say contrary to what is being said here in Habakkuk, they're thinking that what we're going to do is the church is here, and we're just going to keep, you know, sweeping in the world, taking in nation after nation after nation, and we just keep building. Eventually, the whole earth is going to be filled with the knowledge of God. Now, if you push it eschatologically, I think that's going to take place when Jesus returns and sets up his kingdom, and the whole world will be filled with his knowledge. If you're amillennial, that's what you're doing right now. You're not just evangelizing people so they miss the wrath of God. You're evangelizing them as a political opportunity, because this is how we get control of the nations. We're going to Christianize them. Does that make sense what I'm saying? I'm up here. I think we should evangelize the whole way. I think even as you're being martyred, you're testifying to Christ, and the whole world will hear of the gospel of Jesus Christ and his coming kingdom. I believe in evangelism. I believe in outreach. I believe in being a good testament, or a good testimony. But I also believe the world is not going to change. You're not going to get rid of the sin nature. You're not going to get rid of Satan. You're not going to get rid of the fallen world. But this right here, this model, amillennialism, you have to keep hoping that there's going to be, you've got to somehow, in my mind, eschatologically, again, it may be true, it may not be true, but eschatologically, Islam is a perfect candidate for the kingdom of the beast, because it's been here for 1,400 years. It's anti-Jesus, it's anti-Trinity, it's anti-Christian, it's anti-Jew. It fits perfect. Now, if that's what's going to happen, I don't know. So Islam is going to be part of the persecution. It is today part of the persecution. It's been a part of the persecution for 1,400 years. In the amillennial model, you have to somehow wrap your mind around or stretch your mind around the fact that eventually Islam is going to come face to face with the church and go, my gosh, we've been wrong. And they're going to have an Islamic revival, and Islam is going to turn their nations to Christ, and we're going to have the kingdom of God on earth, because the church is marching forward victorious in the earth. And that I began to think about that, maybe how depending on what article you're reading and who your commentator is on your talk show, if they're premillennial, they're looking at doom and gloom. I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying this is what's supposed to happen. Pretty soon they're going to be building the temple and the Antichrist is going to be here. Doom and gloom. And, I remember talking to Steve Dace, and he was critical of this, because, you know, we're all just defeatists. Where this right here, they're not doom and gloom, they're conquer. How do you spell conquer? There's a Q-U-E-R. They're conquering for Christ, and everything, we may have had a setback in Afghanistan, but it is only for the church to win the Taliban to Christ and have an Islamic rule. We're up here, doom and gloom, it's supposed to happen. Persecution here, you're going to end up conquering. So keep that in mind, and you've got your own eschatology. one doesn't override the other. We're still going to evangelize. But I think there's a limit to evangelism, because there's going to be, in the end, there's going to be nations that resist God, curse God, and refuse to come to God. Well, keep that in mind as we continue here with this chapter 2. Anybody want to say something about that? That wasn't planning on going down that road. Does that make sense? Is that interesting? Yes? Because, I mean, you can hear it in your commentators. If they're thinking the church is going to be victorious, they're going to be a little more positive. They're going to, just like everybody twists things, you know, if it's CNN or Fox News or Democrats or Republicans, premillennial and amillennial will twist the events. Like, I'm premillennial, so everything I see, I'm looking at it as, Jesus is coming back, the world is going to hell, and the Antichrist is coming somewhere. Look out, here he comes. Where if you're amillennial, you're not really worried about the Antichrist, okay? Just stay positive, because it's all going to work out. Because it's like the church is marching forward. We may have had a setback, but soon the Taliban will come to Christ. I mean, it's just a matter of time. You cannot resist the grace of God. And you're looking at it this way. And so it's like you're looking at the same story or the same situation, and you're reporting it two different ways. Now, I'm not saying one's evil. I'm just saying I see this happen, and I say, looks like we're heading towards the Antichrist. They say, looks like a setback. Soon we're going to win the Taliban. Anyway, keep that in mind when you hear people talk, especially talk show hosts. There is a place where it could be important. I make it sound like it's just whatever you want. But one is true and one is not. And it's going to cause a lot of confusion if you're amillennial and all of a sudden you start seeing the end time events start taking place and there's no victory on this side of history for the church. The church dies. The martyrs are under the altar and God is letting his church be slaughtered. We're like sheep before Romans, like sheep before its shears was silent. You know, the same things, but we're not. In the end, we're going to be victorious. But in history, like Habakkuk's talking about, we're going to face opposition. We're going to face overwhelming opposition. But the just will live by faith. You're not going to have the victory in time. You're going to have the victory when Jesus Christ comes back. So I think that's, if you're thinking that the church is going to be victorious, I don't know, it'd be kind of hard to face martyrdom knowing that, unless you think the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. Okay, I'm way off topic. But that's something I was wrestling with myself as I was reading different articles saying, why don't I have that much hope in the underground church, like they're going to win the Taliban? So I'm not even thinking they're going to win the Taliban. I'm thinking they're going to be slaughtered. So I might be wrong. Likewise, point C, Babylon are led further into their vices by wine, and they're never at rest, meaning they're always going further and further to conquer. You know, their borders keep expanding. Point two, under C on page two, 2C2, greed is as wide as Sheol. They're always wanting more stuff. They gather for himself all nations or collects all the peoples. They're always absorbing more and more nations into their empire. Eventually, it's too big. The Babylonian sin nature, their wine, their wealth, or their arrogance prevents them from stopping short of disaster. I turn to page three. That's point F. That's what I was reading about earlier, trying to find it. Ancient historians characterize Babylonians always at this time as being heavy drinkers. Arrogance mixed with wine is like a truck going down a hill, point H. Or the Babylonians' arrogance was like wine because they could not stop. They were never at rest, greed as wide as Sheol. They never have enough, gather all nations, collect all people. There's the word greed is the word Sheol, and it comes from a form of Sheol right there in the text. Its general meaning is the underworld. And that explains how it's large and can keep taking up space. Point four, gathers all nations, collects all people. That's political conquest. All other concerns and interests are set aside, just like someone that is betrayed by wine. You have some other important issues you should deal with, but you're drunk on power or you're drunk on wine, so you keep marching forward. You'll wonder if something like that's taking place in our own government. I mean, people are rushing across the border. We've got all kinds of, we're just printing money, sending money out. It's like, are you so drunk on the power of being in charge of the Congress or being in charge of the White House or having all the Hollywood celebrities sing your praises that you're just like not taking care of business? You're too busy just, no, that's not true. That's not, lying and just doing these ridiculous, because looking back, it'd be like looking at Babylon going, what are you thinking? I mean, you can't just keep going. You're going to crash. But they're drunk on political power. They're drunk on military power. They're drunk on arrogance. Or they're drunk on wine. Something is causing them to be ridiculous, and it's going to cause them to blow up, crash. And then you look at our nation, and I think some people look at things and you can't explain it. What are you? I mean, just the Afghanistan situation. You look at it, go like, people say, "Ah, well, it wasn't planned very well," or else it was planned perfectly. It was planned exactly like they wanted, but it's like, what do you think? Are you so drunk on power that you think you're going to cooperate with all these other nations? You're going to accommodate China. You're going to accommodate Russia. You're going to accommodate everybody. We're all going to be one big happy family. You're drunk. You're drunk on political power. It's going to betray you. You're going to be mocked and laughed at because it doesn't work that way. I mean, because you know there are incompetent people in all positions in life. We have incompetent people in government, but we're talking about the government like this, from the president, all the generals. I mean, you're going down to this whole group. You're going to say the whole group's incompetent? I mean, okay, the president's incompetent, maybe. But it's like, who's his advisor? I mean, everybody in the White House staff, everyone, incompetent. Everyone drunk on power? Or is it exactly what they wanted? And we're down here going, what's going on? Well, this is the elite. And even then, the elite, if that's what they're doing, they are drunk on power. They've got a plan. They're pulling it off, but it is not going to, it's going to blow up in their face. Again, I have no insight. I'm just doing the same thing you are, watching things take place. And it's like, okay, back to the text. Point five, it says, those who believe the Lord will wait and trust. In other words, they're trusting the Lord. They're going to wait and trust through this whole thing. That's what Habakkuk is being said. The just will live by faith. You're just going to have to trust me that this plan is going to come to an end. If it be premillennial, Jesus comes back, or it's amillennial, the church is going to conquer. I don't think Habakkuk was thinking the church was going to conquer. You just got to have to wait and trust. Those who march to the arrogance of their own human nature will perish. It is a natural result, but you must wait for it. Babylon is coming down. But what do we do in the meantime? He's told, you must wait. There's not a thing you can do. You're going to have to live by faith, and you're going to have to wait. That's the message. They're at the top of their game, but they are coming down. They'll be taken down by the Persians. This principle is applicable in everyday life, but the focus here is eschatological. This principle will eventually resolve everything. It will bring about the day of the Lord, which is wrath for the arrogant, salvation for those with faith. And that's, again, that's part of my pre-millennial discussion, meaning this is going to continue. This is going to continue on like this until Jesus Christ comes at the end. Wait for it. Though it linger, wait for it. It will not delay. It's coming right here. This whole time, it's like, what's going on? What's going on? It's so confusing. It's like, the just will live by faith. It's going to happen. You're going to be vindicated. Every one of these is going to come collapsing down right here. And then comes the kingdom of God. I mean, for me, again, it's because I see it this way. This all is teaching premillennial. This is not teaching, and then the people of the earth conquer for Jesus Christ or the Messiah. Now, point three, or on page three, the bottom of page three. Shall not, this says, after describing their arrogance and they're crashing and burning, they're going to come down. Wait for it. Point chapter 2, verse 6. Shall not all these take up their, I got it underlined, taunt against him with scoffing and riddles. So three things. All these. First of all, it says all these. Who is all these? All these are the nations and the peoples that had been taken captive, that had been plundered by the Babylonians, or whoever is in the place of the Babylonians. All these, and this would be, in this historical case, the Persians and the Medes, historically, because that's what's coming next. Shall not all these take up their taunt? Here's the words. Taunt is the English word, T-A-U-N-T. Take up their taunt, scoffing, and it says riddles. And that's exactly, those are three important words. Because what we're going to see, we got five woes coming in the rest of this chapter. And I'm going to show you, as you, and you can go through and look at it yourself. We're going to see this whole thing is going to be the taunts, the scoffing, and the riddles. These nations that were conquered by Babylon are going to say to Babylon as they crash, as they fall. Interesting. You see right there? They're again, not to be merciless, not to say God is not reaching out to the lost, but those, there are mockers in the world today. There are those who have shut God off. They're rejecting God. They are going to perish. And they're going to be taunted, they're going to be scoffed, and they're going to have, well, here it is. Turn the page. We're looking at right now chapter 2, verse 6b, the first half of that verse, because halfway through chapter 2, verse 6 begins the first woe, where it says, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own for how long and loads himself with pledges. We'll talk about that later. But right now we're looking at the first part. Shall not all these, whoever they were conquering, take up their taunts against him with scoffing and riddles for him? Turn the page, and there you've got, on the top of page 4, you've got those three words. You got to read them backwards. The word proverb is the word mashal, M-A-S-A-L in the Hebrew. The next word, taunting, is right there, you militia. And what you want to focus on, forget the you, and just look at militia. And then a riddle, and that you got he, doit. Again, I'm making these pronunciations up. When you go down there to point 3, the five woes we're going to read here, starting next week probably, include these three parts: a proverb, a mashal, and a mashal, M-A-S-A-L, a proverb, right? That's a that proverb is a, well, that would be the, I'm trying to figure out how that's, let me look at this, I got mixed up here. Taunting is clearly taunting, a riddle is clearly riddle, so the proverb would be a taunt. Let me write that right here, proverb. And this is what it is. A proverb, a mashal, would be a proverbial saying, a figurative speech, or a mocking byword. A taunt, melissa, or melissa, which is a word that comes from the Hebrew word lis, L-I-S, which means to scorn, to deride, or to mock. And then riddle, hidat. This is the ideal of a riddle or an elusive saying, meaning it's like what, it's like it's got a double meaning. The riddle may include words that have double meaning. Like you may say this, but it also means this, and both are applicable. And so there, in hermeneutics, exegetical teaching, the principle is a word only has one meaning. Meaning when the author wrote this word, it means this. It can't mean this and this and this. It meant one thing. That's what was he thinking? That's why he used that word. Does that make sense? And he uses that. He was thinking, he had a thought that was expressed in a word. So you can't say, well, that word also means this. Well, that's not what the author was thinking. That may be a dictionary meaning of the word, but the author was thinking, you got to find out what the author was thinking. What was the intention of the author? But with that also being said, when you get into proverbs, taunting, and riddles, riddles means in their talking, they're going to use a word that's got two meanings. It's going to have double meaning. They're making fun. They're saying this. It's like Saturday Night Live, or it's kind of like a skit. It's some kind. They say this, but it's actually poking fun of you over here. You're looking here, but we're actually saying this. So it is exegetically, that's exactly what it's supposed to. It's a word with double meaning, and they're making fun. They're mocking the Babylonians here. So those are those words. I'm going to read now chapter 2. I've got it written there, 6 through 8, right there on page 4. So this is the first woe. We're not going to get through all of it. I'm going to introduce it. And listen for these things. Listen for the taunting, the scoffing, the riddles with double meanings. There's going to be words in the Hebrew. Now, again, this has been translated. So in the Hebrew, there's going to be words that rhyme or that are funny to say because they're like they have like a funny way of sounding together, so which makes them memorable. They're something that they're going to be songs. Nonetheless, here's the English translation. The first woe of riddles and taunting and mocking. Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own for how long and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you for the blood of man and the violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. So, again, that's loaded up. I mean, that could take, I mean, I've just read it to you, but all that's got a lot of expression in it. Here's some things on page 5. I'll just point these out. There's similar sounds, chapter 2, verse 6, and you have to go up to the Hebrew to see this. Chapter 2, verse 6b, there's two lows, low and low. They sound the same, but they've got different meanings. In fact, if you look on page, I'm looking for it right now. Yeah, on page 4 at the top, you know, I've got those three circles on the transliteration. If you look in the second line down, and you're going to start on the right and count over two words. It says, to him who increases not what is his. So you go, it's hamarba, low, low. So there's two lows right there. It's just interesting. They have the same sound, but two different meanings. That's the first one. And then the phrase in the English, point 1b in chapter 2, verse 8, in the English, for the bloody gorings of men. And it's written in the Hebrew, it's written, medadim adem. So it's got the word Adam and then the word, the bloody gorings of Adam. So the medadim adem is how it would say, so again, that's me pronouncing Hebrew. But again, for the bloody gorings of men, that just sounds gross. But in the Hebrew, it'd be midadim adim. So you got that funny sound to it. That may be intentional. Double meanings. Talks about your creditors. Your creditors will arise. Your creditors, the word means bite. It is also used for a creditor. So it can mean someone that takes a bite, or it can mean a creditor. And that's what a creditor does. A creditor takes a bite out of the one who he loaned to. And so the Babylonians are being told, will not your creditors, those that you took stuff from, suddenly rise up and take a bite out of you? In other words, they're going to take their part back. Everyone's going to take a bite out of Babylon. And that's the word creditor, but it also means the bite. And pledges, in chapter 2, verse 6b, means the weight of a pledge or heavy debts, those that you have given heavy debt to, but it also means heaps of mud or thick clay. In other words, you've now taken all of this plunder, you've got all of these things, but the word actually means a heap of clay, a heap of mud. In one sense, it's all these things you've taken. You've taken all these pledges from people, you've got all this, but when you actually say it, it's like it's the same word that means a heap of mud. Proverbs, and we won't read through these, but there's several in here in this where the Proverbs of multiplying ill-gotten gain. And every time, there's three Proverbs that I could read them to you, that if you get ill-gotten gain, it's not going to last. It's going to come back and destroy you. And so right in there, you've taken ill-gotten gain, and just like Proverbs says, it's going to come back. You've taken something that's not yours, and you shouldn't have. And without, it's not necessarily God's retribution or God's divine intervention. It's just the way gravity works. It's just the way nature works. You take something that you don't deserve and you take it to yourself, that's going to be your destruction. And that's three Proverbs say that, and that's said in these. So there's your proverbial side. And then the phrase, sudden disaster. You're going to live this way. You're going to live at this risky level, this arrogance. Then suddenly, disaster will come on you. And here's the same thing. Suddenly, your debtors will arise. You're doing all this, and all of a sudden you turn around, and there they are. The Persians are at your gate, taking a bite out of you. And so that's the proverbial saying. And then, of course, the justice and vengeance, the ideal of this is just the way the world works. Because you have pillaged many nations, what's going to happen? If you've pillaged many nations, what's going to happen to you? All that remains of the people shall pillage you. It's like you did this, and that's what the Proverbs are going to be like, or these woes are going to be like, of building on that. And on the back page, you've got those five woes written out right there. And so as we go through this, we're going to be looking for, in all five of those, and it's the Lord speaking the words of those that have been plundered by Babylon, and they're going to be taunting Babylon, they're going to be scoffing Babylon, they're going to be speaking riddles, words that have double meanings, as they just rapid fire, five woes are spoken to them. And again, the point there being, this is Babylon, but at the same time, this is whoever Babylon, you know, is overthrown by. This is the way, unless a nation or an empire somehow balances themselves out so they are just, that they have some checks and balance. And that's, again, I got to put a plug in there for the United States of America. We have the concept. We don't just have a king like Nebuchadnezzar. I think he was a great leader, a great man. I think he did a great job listening to Daniel. But he was a man that had all power. And he's going to drive the nation. And those that followed him had less integrity than him. They're going to drive the empire into the ground. Look at the Assyrians did. The Persians, even Cyrus was great, but the handed down to the next generation, they just drove it into the ground. America is set up in such a way that their founders, this is the absolute, and you know this, the founders knew history. I mean, we got people talking on the television that are stupid. They don't know history. They make it up. The founding fathers were scholars. They understood history. All this information was available to them. And so when they looked, they were going to start their own. They had to decide, are we going to stay with Britain? Or are we going to tell Britain we're going to start our own nation? And they said, we're going to start our own nation. They fought the war. Now they looked at it. They says, well, they all fought on who's going to be king. No, they all says, we just got rid of a king. We don't want a king. We've got to figure out a way. And they systematically sat down and tried to form the best way of keeping a government, a nation, from becoming another Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome or England. So what can we do? And they got it set. We had to have, as far as we that perfect tension. And they knew, you know, the verse in Isaiah, that the Messiah, when he comes, will be the judge, he'll be the king, and he'll be the lawgiver. You know that verse? I could look it up. You know what I'm talking about? The Messiah will be the judge, the lawgiver, and the king. And they says, we don't have the Messiah, but we need a judge, the judicial branch. We need a king, the presidential executive branch. We need the lawgiver. There's your branch of lawgiving, or the legislative branch. And we're going to put all three of them in tension with each other, that none of them are going to have any, they're going to have to cooperate and work together and check each other. Because in a sense, they took mankind, divided them up into government positions, and they created a Messiah. Knowing it wasn't the Messiah, but they took the character traits of a Messiah and wove it into the government, because until the Messiah comes, this is the best we've got. We've just got each other. And I don't trust you. You shouldn't trust me. We didn't trust them, and we don't trust our descendants. We know human. It's like, well, that's the thing. We're right here. Well, we got to trust the government. We got to trust each other. It's like, no. That's the reason I want you to have a Bible. I don't want you to come to Bible study and I'll tell you about God. I mean, I want you to trust me in the sense that I'm trying to do the best I can. But you should be like, well, you know, I made some comments about eschatology. Well, am I right? I don't know. Don't trust me. You want to be able to double check. That's what's great about the Protestant church, is they've got Bibles. The Catholic church is going one direction. All right. That's where we're at. I think we've got a place where we had a nation that could at least avoid this pitfall. But if we collapse, if we continue to give way to what we call freedom, and it's really not just freedom, it's the idea of a government that's protecting us from this. That's what our government is protecting us from, this very situation, supposed to be. So that you have freedom, because the government is not this right here. If this sets in a Nebuchadnezzar type, you know, a government that's absolute power, yeah, you'll lose your freedom. But what's going to happen is it's going to drive you right off the cliff. You're going to be the one being taunted, scoffed, and riddles spoken about. We may have seen that in Afghanistan. And we may have seen that right there. Here we are, and instead of following basic protocol, we made something up. And what are we doing? Anyway, I'll quit with that right here. I'll pray, and you're free to go. Father, do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would, again, handle the Scriptures diligently, but we'd also apply them to our own lives that we may see the truth, live the truth, and be a good witness for you at this time in history. Father, we do pray for our nation. We pray for our churches. We pray for our families and ask that the churches around the world would again, be given strength, and they would continue to testify to your glory, and again, that you'd have mercy on them. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.